Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, everyone. I am Leona Abraham Brando, host for Blog Talk Radio, Shedding Light. As many of you know, Blog Talk Radio, Shedding Light, is committed to bringing awareness of the many issues resulting in mass incarceration. Our guest and host today will be Donna Wynette, founder of Families, Friends, and Individuals for the Mentally Ill, as well as being involved with the Bridgewater Families Group. They will be bringing awareness today of some of these issues and the results of untreated and ineffective treatment. Donna and her fellow advocates will be discussing how movies, films, and TV shows depict mental illnesses and drug addictions and alcohol, which is a serious issue in the United States of America. Please call in to give feedback, ask questions, or simply just to listen in. Again, the phone number is 657-383-1630. Let's welcome now Donna Wynette, host for Blog Talk Radio today, and her fellow advocates who will be also be coming on at some point in time to speak on mental illnesses in America. Okay, Donna Wynette, are you on with us?
I am. Hello, Leona. Nice to talk with you again.
I want you to introduce yourself to the audience once again and take over. The show is yours today. Thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you for the opportunity. Thank you, Leona. So my name is Donna Wynette. I'm the founder and director of an organization. It's a grassroots organization called FEMI, and that stands for Family and Friends of Individuals with Mental Illness. That's FFIMI, and we pronounce it FEMI. And we advocate for those who are justice involved. So what we are is grassroots advocacy group, and we're focused on providing a voice for people with serious mental illness in the criminal justice system. And beyond that, we're learning so much about incarceration, and it's become a bigger picture for us. So we're also interested in the ills of incarceration, criminal justice reform, reentry services, and much more. And my organization is expanding and growing to include so many concerns within the system, so I'll keep you updated on that. In the meantime, I just want to talk about mental disorders and how they're depicted in TV shows and films. And I'm no expert by no means, but thought it might be a stimulating topic and something that might help educate, destigmatize. Film could have that power to do that. And before starting, I just want to say that mental disorders comprise a broad range of problems with different symptoms. However, they are generally characterized by some combination of abnormal thoughts, emotions, behavior, and relationships with others. So they're brain disorders, and my opinion and my expertise, my experience, all says that when someone becomes involved in the criminal justice through behavioral disorders, you know, their thoughts are disordered. They're not committing criminality for the sake of criminality. Therefore, they deserve treatment rather than punishment. So that's all about FEMI. And now to maybe talk a little bit about films and mental illness. A friend of mine, a fellow family member from the Bridgewater Family Group, had said that, you know, she was impressed by a TV show she recently saw, and that she was grateful that it depicted mental illness with some sense of integrity and empathy. So the impact of negative portrayals of mental illness in the past, and still ongoing, but there is some improvement, but some of the negative impacts would be, you know, they would talk about the dark era of asylums and torture to the light, but we want to go to the light of human rights and neurobiological interpretations, so that much of the stigma that surrounds mental illness and remains in society, by using film in a better way, in a more compassionate way, in a way that would depict it with more reality and sympathy could turn around and bring more light to the ways that people suffer with mental illness. And, you know, so decades of research, decades, have established that many people have inaccurate and negative beliefs about psychiatric disorders. And I find that to be true, which is why such a large percentage of people with serious mental illness and mental illness and brain disorders end up in our prison systems. We don't have the proper safety and psychiatric facilities and treatment that is needed. They're treated as criminals because there's lack of awareness. So, you know, these portrayals of mental illness in film can be superficial, stigmatizing, and inaccurate. However, some, you know, there is some progress, and that's what I want to talk about, some of the positives that could happen. Movies can serve as therapeutic tools to aid discussion about patients' fears and misconceptions and work to amend these issues in a supportive environment. And with the high rates of mental illness in America, along with the stigma, the unearned stigma surrounding these illnesses, it is important to spread awareness, shine light on what mental illnesses are and how they can be treated. Therefore, the filmmakers have, they maybe not a responsibility, but they have an opportunity to, you know, create films that to create films with the input of mental health professionals, individuals with mental illness, and the public, and then work towards more authentic, informational, and hopeful depictions of mental illness. So that would be the goal. That would be nice to push the filmmakers to do those kinds of things. Contact mental health professionals, get the information correct. Talk with individuals who suffer mental illness. That's firsthand information. And the public to work towards more authentic, informational, and hopeful depictions of mental illness. That would be great. But filmmakers will not change what is bringing in revenue without the push from policymakers and the public. And they will not know how to depict mental illness in a truthful and educational manner without input from those professionals and individuals with mental illness. So there's a collaboration that could be formed to create better filmmaking. So that being said, there are some good films. There's listed good films that depict mental illness as is and in a better light, and to show that sometimes appropriate medication, appropriate treatment, you know, could be helpful. They show the anxieties and the PTSD and some of the symptoms that people suffer without making them into villains and criminals and monsters. So one of the earliest films was Days of Wine and Roses, which was done in 1962, an American drama film, and it starred Jack Lemmon and Lee Remick, who did an amazing depiction of what alcoholism was like. So it starts out with the main character, Joe Clay, and he is, you know, he has a problem with alcohol. She was a teetotaler, never drank, but right upon drinking, she found that it made her feel good, and she descends into alcoholism, and it's quite poignant. It ends up where Joe Clay just realizes the toll it's taking on him, his daughter, his health, and he seeks help through Alcoholics Anonymous, but unfortunately, the wife he introduced to drinking, she does not get well, and it ends there. So it's a real depiction of what can happen with alcoholism. Is anybody want to talk about a movie or a TV show that has impacted them or they felt was negative or positive? Anybody of the callers?
Nothing
okay,
yet.
So I'll go on. Oh, hello?
No, nothing yet.
Okay. So another film that personally affected me was called Ironweed, and that was filmed in 1987, an America drama film, and that was actually filmed in my hometown of Albany, New York, which the author of the book, Ironweed, a man whose last name was, William Kennedy, wrote that. He was a Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. So that was done by Jack Nicholson and Meryl Streep. And again, you know, it shows these alcoholics and during the 1930s depression and how the main character named Francis Phelan, he had been a retired baseball player, but now was washed up. He deserted his family because he had dropped his infant son to the ground, causing the child's death. That caused him so much trauma and untreated trauma that he resorted to alcoholism. And at one point, his family tries to bring him back into the fold. His wife, his still wife, brings him home, cleans him up, but he couldn't sustain it. He goes back to the streets and back to a fellow alcoholic, which was played by Meryl Streep. And they're very loving to each other, very supportive, but not able to help one another. And it depicts where she ends up passing away. Another favorite of mine was called Benny and June, and that was Johnny Depp. I liked his earlier movies, and he played, this was 1993, and it was a romantic comedy drama film, and it's about two odd people and a woman named Juniper, who was known as June, thus the Benny and June. And she, you know, she's kind of agoraphobic in a way. She little quirky. They lost their parents, and she depends on her brother. But something inside of her wants to break free and wants to be her own person. Thus, along comes the quirky Benny, played by Johnny Depp, and it's really hilarious, and it's actually heartwarming. And you actually, you know, it's not a serious kind of mental illness. But it's a depiction of these two people who, you know, have some mental health issues, but are still so lovable and likable and fun. So that was a movie that I really, really liked. And then some of the movies that our therapist recommended would be A Beautiful Mind. I think that's a movie well known, and that was played by the critically acclaimed Russell Crowe. And it featured the real-life mathematician John Nash, who suffered from schizophrenia, one of the most serious of mental illness. And, you know, he would have delusional episodes. And a PhD named Laurie Holman says the film is certainly worth a watch. And it says he gets help from a psychiatrist at a hospital and then manages. So there's management to seemingly control his mind to the degree that by the end, he casually asks the student if what he sees is real, which she confirms. Then he receives, to his surprise and wonder, a great accolade and honor as a scientist. So that depicts, you know, success in the management of a disease, but also it depicts the reality of some of the struggles that this disease brings. And then off to a book, before I go on to the next movie, is Maurice Binard, who is the star of General Hospital, one of the stars. And he suffers from bipolar disorder. And he wrote a book. He's in General Hospital. He's been one of those major stars of General Hospital for many years. So his book is called Nothing General About It. And the subtitle is How Love and Lithium Saved Me On and Off General Hospital. And I like the book very much because it's very authentic, and he tells it like it is. He tells of his struggles, and one of the heartwarming, he very, very descriptively makes you feel the angst and the anxiety and some of the suffering that one has because bipolar disorder, and no one chooses to have that. He didn't choose to have that, but he has struggled for years. And one good thing now is that he's a fierce advocate. He's worked with NAMI and other groups and reached out to people with mental illness. So, you know, it shows a depth of understanding and caring. And so the book is called Nothing General About It, How Love and Lithium Saved Me On and Off General Hospital. And that being said, medication is just one component of the care that mentally ill people need. And I will go into that a little bit later. What was I going to say? Oh, I know. When he got hired at General Hospital, you know, he was about to step in and he had a breakdown, a mental breakdown. And to their credit, they actually, this is at the very, very beginning of his hiring, and they actually worked with him, and in turn, they were rewarded with having someone of great caliber, of acting experience, who has coached his fellow actors. Had they not, you know, had they just given up on him, oh, we hired this guy and he's got mental issues, we've got to get rid of him really quickly, but they didn't do that. And instead, you know, he was able to move on, move forward, help others. So that's a really good success story. So that being said, is there anyone back to my topic of mental illness on TV, on movies? Anybody else have anything to say today?
I think what you're talking about is excellent, Donna. It really is, and it's so much needed. And as you say, videos and movies, they depict all of these issues that you and your organizations are currently dealing with.
Yes. And there's negatives, but the hope is that there are some new positives too. They say the documentary about Amy Winehouse, who died at the young age of 27. I've heard her songs, her CD, and her voice is sultry and beautiful. She could have given so much of that gift to the world, and instead, you know, she struggled with mood disorders and behavioral issues and drug addiction that led to her early death. And it's really heartbreaking. But for them to make a documentary to shed light on this, hopefully, you know, I would love to see documentaries. I hope to actually see my grandson, who is a budding filmmaker. I'd like to see him do a documentary maybe on his cousin, you know, with mental illness, on those issues, and bring to light, not just, you know, tell the story, but give resources for people to reach out and the resources to do better, they can do better. And there's such a lack of that in our society. So that's why we need these sympathetic portrayals. And they, you know, a sympathetic portrayal of mental illness, it can be reassuring for not only the sufferers and their families, but, you know, for others within society. Because if they have understanding, they can not have fear of people who act differently from us. So let's see. I thought, you know, there's a lot of movies about mental illness, but there's certain ones that are recommended by therapists. So I thought those were pretty good to highlight. And another one is called Silver Linings Playbook. Have you seen any of these movies, by the way, Leona? Did you get to see A Beautiful Mind or...
No, I haven't. But there is a caller that may have. 718, do you want to state your name, please?
Ify.
Hi, Iffy. Welcome to the show. I would love to hear.
Hi, Donna.
I would love to hear anything you would have to say. I have to say that Iffy is a very very big supporter of helping people with mental illness and supporting the families. So thank you and welcome, and please weigh in.
Yeah, I'm joining, but I'm at work.
So are there any, like, TV shows or films that you have, you know, seen that you felt that, you know, depicted correctly or depicted mental illness in a very negative way? And what might you like to see?
Oh, are you referring to me?
Yes.
I'm not going to be able to talk much. I told you I'm at work. I'm just
okay.
Going to listen.
Okay, so you can listen. Okay, thanks, Iffy. Thanks for being there. And so another film that's therapist recommended would be The Silver Linings Playbook. And this movie showed up in multiple therapist lists too. So multiple therapists thought that The Silver Linings Playbook is a showcase. It's a good thing for exposing mental illness for what it is. And it calls it, this one person who's a PhD calls it one of the most accurate movies portraying bipolar disorder. So it demonstrates that bipolar isn't what we usually think it is, which is rapid mood swings every day, all day. So that's what we usually think it is, but it demonstrates that that's what it isn't. And the impact of living with such a disorder on someone's life and the challenges that they go through. And this PhD, this actually PhD psychologist says, I remember when I watched it the first time, how impacted I was by the accuracy of the representation so rare in big Hollywood productions. So I would say that's a win, you know, in the battle to destigmatize mental illness. So I haven't seen that yet, so I have to put it on my to-do list, but The Silver Linings Playbook. And the next one, The Soloist, another PhD doctor, Matthew Walsh, says this is one of his favorite mental health movies. It starred Robert Downey Jr. and Jamie Foxx and documented the friendship between a Los Angeles journalist who befriends a schizophrenic, homeless, Juilliard-trained musician. I did see this, and it was, it was heartwarming, heartbreaking, but beautiful, because that's what we need to do in society, you know, is to befriend and treat people with serious mental illness, treat them with the dignity they deserve as human beings, the dignity that they are a person. They may have some brain disorders, some differences in the way they think and feel, but they're still precious human beings. And this is what that movie, The Soloist, really talked about, how this, you know, this Los Angeles journalist who obviously was successful, and he meets this schizophrenic, homeless musician. You know, you would just think he's a down and outer, but he was Juilliard trained musician. So this was an amazing film. And it says throughout the film, Downey struggles between being a good friend and trying to fix Fox, ultimately delivering a powerful theme. Steve is conflicted throughout the movie about whether or not he should try to treat or fix Nathaniel's schizophrenic condition, or if he should accept Nathaniel for who he is and just try to be his friend. That would be such a quandary, wouldn't it? You know, where do we go with helping a person or just accepting them, you know, if they're doing the best they can? That's a fine line we all have to figure out. It would be a difficult thing to figure out. The resolution of the movie, without spoiling the plot, helped me realize that true friendship means to love and accept others for who they are and also for who they are not, even if they have a mental illness that is inhibiting their life. This perspective can open our hearts to allow ourselves the freedom to be who we are and who we are not.
That is something.
It is.
That is something.
Yep.
And that's
then,
why.
That's
why I appreciate, yeah, I was just going to say, Donna, that's why I appreciate what you do and what the work you're doing. Mental illness is a serious issue in the United States, and they do show a lot of movies and films about things like that. Sometimes, like the one with Tom Hanks, you know, he went into the military and he had psychological issues. He was slow,
right,
but he was able to function. But there are so many out there that are, you know, that is so different, and everything is so sad. It really is. People have to take them as they are.
That's true. And I often ponder every time I see a street person with a sign panhandling or walking. Oh, this one really hurts my heart, Leona, when I see a street person walking with a shopping cart with all their stuff. They're trying to hang on to their things. That's all they have in the world. But eventually, if you're homeless, I think, you know, most homeless people end up without their things. Some may, you know, some may get temporary housing or, you know, maybe even permanent housing in a boarding house or somewhere in a group home. But it's such a loss, and you wonder, you know, does this person have mental illness, you know, and sometimes we look at these homeless people and think, oh, they're just drug addicts or most likely alcoholics, because I've been told anyway by a former drug addict that drug addicts generally don't panhandle because they need so much more money to get their drugs. So generally, you know, but that could be, that's from a former drug addict. So I don't know if that's a stereotype or not, but you have to wonder, you know, is this person, you know, have a mental illness? Do they have codependency? And, you know, we look at addiction and we condemn it a lot of times thinking it's a choice, but sometimes those addictions come with mental illness because people are trying to control what they feel or what they don't understand. And unfortunately, in many, many cases, mental illness and dependency on drugs or alcohol, you know, are related. So, you know, it's just heartbreaking to see these people. And, you know, I just wish we were not a throwaway society. I wish we could find more and more, you know, solutions, even if they're a solution here, if we have to do it in manageable chunks, maybe not on a federal level, on a state level, but on a community level, you know, people stepping up and getting some help for some of these people. Wouldn't that be great, Leona?
It would, but it's impossible at times. It seems that way. There's a lawyer right in Boston who has a son on Cape Cod in a group home. And it was in the paper about a few years back, where he went missing. I guess he left the group home, but he's in the group home because he's a schizophrenic. And it's sad because families don't know what to do sometimes, so they put their loved ones in group homes, or they, you know, they just can't deal with it, and they end up in prison eventually. So, you know, we have to understand these things, and we have to try to work towards it, as you've been trying to do yourself.
Right, correct. Yeah, it's just wrong to, you know, warehouse people with serious mental illness, with mental illness. It's wrong to warehouse them in punitive jails and prisons. And yet our jails and prisons are full of people who have serious mental illness and mental illness. And you know, Leona, LaShawn, what is his last name, the young man who was eaten by bed bugs in a psychiatric unit in a jail.
I just heard about it yesterday. Someone was telling me about it. I couldn't believe it.
His cell, they showed photos of the cell. Deplorable, filthy conditions. And these stories just break your heart. And, you know, I just urge so many people, you know, I was not involved in the area of mental illness until it hit my family, but I ask people, you know, who may not have experienced it to learn a little, care a little, do a little. If you can't do a lot, use your voice. You know, do a little something to help someone in your community, because mental illness is a very difficult ongoing disease for those who suffer, and it's a very difficult journey for the families who love them. I'm one of those.
Yeah.
So you know, another, what's
it's
that,
sad.
Leona?
It's really sad.
It really is sad. So, you know, hopefully, you know, this is a brand new topic I'm bringing up to, you know, think of a different way, a new way. You know, hey, guys, you filmmakers make good movies about people with mental illness. You know, even if you plug it in a little here, a little there, shed light and create empathy, because that's what's warranted. So,
can I ask a question, Donna?
Sure.
Have you ever thought to reach out to some of these, like Diane Sawyer or Barbara Walters? Well, I think Barbara.
Yes. Yep. There's someone in the Bridgewater family group who suggested 60 Minutes. She has some contact with them. And, you know, I have actually reached out to Dr. Phil. My husband's quite frustrated because get back to the 60 Minutes. But, you know, I reached out to Dr. Phil because for a long stint, recent, you know, after COVID, he decided instead of spotlighting certain individuals, he would hit up on the topics. And he has covered so many topics that, you know, many of them are very worthy. Cancel culture, transgender, how we handle transgender. So some of the big, big issues, racism, reverse racism, inflation, everything, every topic you can think of, except criminal justice reform. And I've written him multiple times over the years. I've kicked it up, trying to get a national spotlight on the need for reform, for criminal justice reform. So my husband's a little frustrated. That being said, you know, I'm sure he gets multiple requests, but you know, I don't understand that that's a topic he has not covered, because I've heard him say on air, you know, that he doesn't believe that people with mental illness belong in jails and prisons. So, you know, maybe someday I'll get a call from Dr. Phil, who knows. But another thing on my – I have a good to-do list, and another thing on my to-do list is to, you know, if need be – if nobody, they listen, but there's no action, you know, then we go to 60 Minutes and we ask for, you know, do a documentary, you know, expose what works, expose what doesn't work. So, yes, that's on my to-do list.
Can I add something to that?
Absolutely.
Everyone's pretty much aware of the event we're going to be putting on in June. I had a list of the different things that we're going to be talking about, and I tell everyone they don't have to talk about every one of them, whatever issues relate to their situations, that they can do it. But I've been sharing email addresses and contact information, addresses and everything. Dr. Phil and 60 Minutes, if you could get those numbers, and then and we can do it in June as well, is make calls to them and ask them if they can start doing something on mental illnesses and actually giving them your contact information so they can reach out to you. If we do this on a mass basis with phone calls, letter writing, and emails, I guarantee you would probably hear from Dr. Phil, 60 Minutes, and all the others.
I'm going to do that. I'm going to follow up. You know, all I do is I go on Dr. Phil's website, and it's contact Dr. Phil, and you write, you know, used to constrict the amount of letters you could do, you know, to get your message, and it was really hard to get your message across, and they've expanded that. So I will contact him and mention, you know, and talk about the June event, that this would be great timing.
We would do it. You wouldn't even have to let him know. Just we need to let him know that mental illness in America and in American prisons is very prevalent, and we need to get the voices heard and people, the advocates, and mention. We can mention your organization, Families, Friends, and Individuals for Mentally Ill, and also Bridgewater Families groups on prison and mental illnesses. If we do this on a mass basis and we contact his show, his website, his studio, or whatever, and all the others that are the regular talk shows, we could push it to have them start
That's
talking
true.
About mental illnesses and to bring awareness to them that Bridgewater Families Group and FEMA are heavily involved in trying to, you know, come up with resolutions and would like to be on the show.
Absolutely. I've written it down, and I will do that. I like action, Leona.
Yes,
you know.
We'll do it in the June event. We will do it in the June event, and we just need the contact information and everything. And I hope the audience is listening so they can also participate. And I'll let you
know. I hope so, too.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, is there anybody else on the line that might like to speak up about TV shows and TV movies, a movie that might have had an impact, maybe some of the movies I've mentioned already, and if not, I guess I can go on.
Please go on. There's no one on right now. There's no others calling in.
Okay, great. Okay, so, you know, that being said, it's said that films will reach millions of people. Oh, excuse me, Leona.
Bless you.
Unexpected cough there. Films will reach millions of people who will never read a psychology textbook or who will never be in therapy. So films have this tremendous potential for shaping public attitudes to mental illness. And realistic presentations of people with mood or behavioral issues can help promote understanding and ease stigma for real sufferers who are plentiful. One in four adults experience mental illness in any given year, and one in 17 lives with a serious condition such as schizophrenia or bipolar disorder, and that's according to NAMI, the National Alliance of Mental Illness. So that's a lot of people who are infected. They say one in four adults, and you would think with those kind of statistics, there would be more sympathy, more compassion. And sometimes I wonder, and, you know, I do see the good people who are there. I celebrate every one of them. They're my heroes. But I also wonder, how do you reel in people who don't have that sense of compassion, who live selfishly or, you know, just, you know, want, they live with greed or, you know, it's just a job. How do you reel them in? And one of the answers was interesting, a little plug for Dr. Christopher Myers, who did a really great thing in providing gourmet coffee for the patients at BSH, just out of the goodness of his heart. And that was such a nice thing that, you know, I interviewed him. And what he, you know, talked about his father who worked at the telephone company and how his father would see people who were homeless and he'd stop and talk with them. He'd share a meal with them. And it caused Dr. Myers to be a sympathetic, compassionate person. And what he said is that, you know, there are people without compassion. So when, you know, people who are working in the system with mentally ill persons, if they don't have that compassion, then they need policies, they need rules, and they need the people with compassion to model it. So even if it's not from their heart, if they're doing it through strict rules and high staff expectations and policies and seeing others who do this and knowing that that's how they must behave, well, we can get, that's what we should get. But we need compassion and we need compassionate action, whether it's from the heart or whether it's, you know, because of laws and rules and regulations. Unfortunately, that's how some people behave, because of those things. So we need to, you know, say to staff members taking care of patients or people with mental illness or, you know, in the criminal justice system with mental illness or even, you know, even the police, the law enforcement, you know, you need to treat people humanely. And, you know, if you're not going to do it out of the goodness of your heart, you know, you're going to have consequences. You have these policies and regulations you must follow. You know, if we had a little more of that, hopefully we'd have better treatment.
I want to, if you mind, don't mind, Donna, I want to bring up something that you are aware of all the shootings that have been taking place across the country.
Yes, it's horrifying.
The Louisiana shooter left a note. And the note revealing mental illnesses and reduction of gun violence and suicides. And if you go on the internet and they type in shooter left note, getting guns with mental illnesses, it's all over the internet. And this was 15 hours ago. It said about a half an hour ago, before opening for business, employees at the Old National Bank branch in downtown Louisiana gathered for a morning. Let me just open this up. Louisiana shooter left notes revealing part of his goal was to show how easily a mentally ill person can buy a gun in the U.S. And it said that one in his home and found on him about police killing, according to law enforcement. Now, this man had a mental illness, and he killed himself too, but it was all he was letting people know that how easy it was to get a weapon, even with a mental illness. The family is devastated. The police were shocked. Anyway, it said that it's talking a lot about it. If you type it in, there's so much about it and the mental illnesses. And this is why mental illness is becoming more prevalent. It's also becoming more open. It says, Louisville shooter left note revealing part of his goal was to show how easily it was to mentally ill. Mental illness and reduction of gun violence and suicide. Louisville shooter left notes revealing part of his situation. I'm just going mental illness and gun violence. You know, these things here, this is only a small portion of it, but mental illness in this country is worse than people actually know or think. It's becoming worse. And we need to look at, it says, is mental illness a risk factor for gun violence? And it is. We need to push for long-term residential treatment facilities for these people that are in that are having mental illnesses, not prison, not jails, but mental health facilities. They need it desperately.
That's very, very true. And I'm trying to look on that. No, I'm trying to find something that I had marked, but I'm not sure I'll find it right now.
ABC News said that blaming mass shootings on the nation's mental health crisis. Okay, mental health, it says one in five adults in the United States experience mental illnesses each year.
So, yeah, Leona, here, on this article, and I'm going to find the name of the article, locking people up is no way to treat mental illness. And
no.
This is by someone who's a judge, and this article is written by a judge who deals with mental health issues and a family member who has a loved one who was involved within the criminal justice system because of his mental illness. So what they say is another kind of goes along with what you were saying. Another priority for action is my word, also targeted at underserved communities and others, is creating regional treatment facilities, just what you said, creating regional treatment facilities for individuals with serious mental illness and complex needs who are otherwise likely to encounter law enforcement agencies and the courts. These facilities need to offer comprehensive and coordinated system of care. We need more community collaborations, you know, of resources for individuals with serious mental illnesses, especially those who experience chronic homelessness, and I would say trauma, I would add trauma, or who may already be frequent and costly recidivists in the justice and healthcare systems. Such centers will need to provide various levels of residential, gotta find the next page, residential treatment, day activity programs, outpatient behavioral health, and primary care. So a coalition and a collaboration of healthcare services. The healthcare end of this will need to cover things as diverse as trauma services and dental work, and I know that firsthand. So here it says, now it goes to, which is nice that they go to this, it says, admit this new capacity for treating behavioral health conditions, we should not forget that law enforcement officers themselves are far from immune. Various studies have reported their rate of post-traumatic stress disorder to be from 15% to 35%, compared with 3.5% for the public generally. So it says last year, and this is a recent article, last year more law enforcement officers died by suicide than in the line of duty. Law enforcement officers often experience high rates of substance use disorders. Mental health treatment, and I would say also training, you know, of de-escalation and compassionate, humane treatment of those under their care. But mental health treatment should be made available to every law enforcement officer outside their department to ensure confidentiality and encourage them to do this. And then they also go on to talk about training and de-escalation, together with help for officers in managing their own trauma and stress, can reduce violent encounters with police and not just those involving serious mental illness. So we want well people to be taking care of the people with mental illness. We don't want, you know, stressed out or, you know, people who are not well and do not behave well to be in law enforcement.
No. And that's, I see that's why they're having a difficult time filling these positions in the prisons and also in the communities. But according to the National Alliance on Mental Illnesses, it says approximately 1 in 5 adults in the U.S. experience mental illnesses. But it goes on to say, this is interesting too, that it says with millions of Americans grappling with mental health challenges, doctors and public health experts interviewed by ABC News question whether it would be feasible to rely on the nation's current mental health infrastructure to stop the would-be shooters. What's happening in this country is we're putting all the money, taxpayers' dollars, into the wrong places. And again, I'm just saying, if they would open up some they closed down all the mental institutions in the United States and chose to use prisons as an alternative. But if they were to open start establishing all of these residential facilities or institutions and have oversight, they need to have oversight not only in the prisons but even opening up these facilities for mental health treatment and have oversight to make sure that they are successful in the projects.
Correct. Yes, so much money is spent to incarcerate, and you know, couldn't some of those monies, as you said, Leona, be, you know, reconfigured and sent elsewhere so that it would be a healthier society, and we didn't do mass incarceration. We are the country who has more, I think it's, 12 times more than the UK alone. I mean, that's just crazy.
Oh, yeah.
Who are the crazy ones, you know, if you want to use that word?
It says globally, they estimate around 1 in 7 people have one or more mental or substance use disorders. And it says even with the pandemic impacting people across the globe, the United States is unique in its epidemic of gun violence, with the nation reporting more violent deaths. Basically, compared to other high-income countries, more are done by mentally ill people.
Yeah. Yeah, it's funny, you know, now that I'm immersed in this topic and this situation, you know, of working among, you know, families, working with families who have loved ones with mental illness, you start to, you know, and I've heard other family members say the same thing, you know, things that they used to see on TV that looked like, you know, such criminality, now they're viewing it within the scope of mental illness. And sometimes it's easy to identify that these, you know, crimes, they're, you know, they're committed by people with brain disorders, with mental illness, you know, and if you haven't had that experience, you know, that there's such judgment on these people as criminals rather than people with a serious, ongoing, chronic disease that
exactly.
desperately needs care and management.
Look at football. It's becoming a known factor now that football, the head injuries from playing football for long periods of time have affected a lot of these football players and getting hit in the head and everything.
True.
You know, this is another thing that, look at, they've been doing more research now on the brain because of the football players that have had serious concussions leading to death, or even like with that Aaron Hernandez, they said something about his head injuries too. But now they're starting to look at a lot of these different types of mental illnesses and the causes of some of them as well.
Yeah, that's a good thing. And that's, you know, this isn't like my foremost goal as far as an advocate for people with serious mental illness is films and TV, but I thought it was interesting to take a look at it, you know, and to encourage it. So what's one interesting thing is they say that, you know, Hispanic people don't always want to recognize. Now, this is someone else saying that, and I'm not, you know, I'm not Hispanic, so I don't know. But, you know, they say that Hispanic population has a harder time, you know, addressing mental health or wanting to admit it. And they're applauding a TV show with an actor named Edgar Quintero. And they show that, you know, he has PTSD, he's been in war, he relives the trauma and the terror, he sees danger everywhere, but he's more than his illness. And they say that, you know, this role that he plays on the TV show is very sensitive and poignant. So I think that, you know, that may help people. And there's another one, a Maria Bamford film. And it talks, you know, about a person with bipolar and how they manage that disease, which I think is really great. Then you have Monk, you know, the obsessive compulsive disorder, who's quirky and lovable, you know, and that's just kind of like Benny and June with Johnny Depp. It's kind of a fun look at it, you know. And I guess Marvel Comics or Marvel movies that do all these heroes, superheroes, the Iron Man 3, he's still a hero, although he deals with anxiety. So that's an interesting concept right there, too. And the same with a movie called The Avengers. You know, this Avenger hero, he does great in helping serve others and save others, and yet he has some anxiety, PTSD, he has panic attacks whenever the trigger, you know, I guess a wormhole, so that's a trigger for him, and he has to fight through that, and yet he can be a hero. And we, you know, we have to start viewing people different and just embracing, celebrating the good in them, you know, and just trying to help them manage whatever mental health issues they might have. And the same with that movie I mentioned earlier, The Silver Linings Playbook, that was about bipolar and mood swings and how stress can exacerbate it. So, you know, that's the kind of thing I just thought it would be kind of a different topic to bring up today, something new for me, something that came to my attention through one of our family support meetings when a family member said, you know, I watched this TV show and, you know, it was really good because they depicted mental illness in a better light as is, or, you know, sympathetically. So that would be a good thing because films have a great impact on the psychological, you know, thinking of human beings. And, you know, in that case, it's probably good to kind of be aware and, you know, try to concentrate on better things as much as we can in this crazy, negative, you know, harsh world. But that being said, you know, I would hope that we would have some films that would be more edifying and helpful.
I think that films are good, as you said, and it does. It depicts a lot of things that are, and I was going to say there's different types of mental illnesses, and I think the way mentally ill function depends on the bringing up they have or the environment around them. There's families that there's parents that care a lot about their loved one when there's a mental illness, and there's some that they don't pay attention enough. They, you know, they bring in help or they send them out to institutions or whatever. But what you're doing is something that there's so many people that have loved ones incarcerated and in the hospitals with mental illnesses. But if people are going to work on getting the right people involved, they need to come together as a whole in unity. And what happens sometimes is if people do not like what they're hearing or they're in disagreement on the subject or whatever, they tend to go the other way, and we're right back to square one sometimes. When we're halfway there, we have to go because it's going to get more difficult as we get closer to resolutions and as we get closer to bringing in the right people. Department of Mental Health has to get involved. American Psychological Association has to get involved. NAMI is out there. NAMI, National Alliance for Prisoners' Rights, for Mental Illnesses, they too should be joining forces with your organization, with Bridgewater Families Group, with all these other organizations dealing with mental illnesses. Network. That's what it's going to take, all of these organizations focusing on mental illnesses to come together and really battle it, because mental illness in the United States of America is overly populated.
Yeah. I do have some good news on that, Leona, that NAMI has been, you know, becoming more aware of our particular situation, our particular population, and they are stepping up. You know, they really are on our side, you know, and they're now moving a little bit more forward toward people people with serious mental illness who are enmeshed within the criminal justice system and the care that they're getting. NAMI at first seemed to be mostly focused, and I think it might still be that way, mostly focused on, you know, mental health and mental illness in general. But now they're moving, progressing forward, and you know, they are offering us some help, which is great. Because we need it.
NAMI was established based on family members with mentally ill loved ones. That's
right.
It's just like
right.
Families Against Mandatory Minimums. NAMI, National Alliance Against Mental Illnesses, was pretty much started by families that had it. So they're basically like you are. They're just more advanced because they've been around for much longer.
Right, right. And Leona, you brought up something about the bringing up of people. Could you touch on that a little bit, you know, how that would affect them and, you know, maybe their mental illness or?
Sometimes we don't realize that our loved ones are going through psychological issues. Sometimes the mental illnesses are not recognized right away, or they're not acknowledged. And a lot of times they're misdiagnosed. You know, I hate to say it, but there's doctors and there's psychologists that even in the prisons, they don't always diagnose these prisoners with the exact mental illness. Again, I say this all the time. They diagnose a lot of prisoners with antisocial behaviors, when in fact, these prisoners, a lot of them, are suffering from post-traumatic stress syndrome. You don't have to be in the military only to be to have PTSD or disorders or symptom PTSS. I'm not with it, but anyway, they diagnose them with antisocial behavior, when in fact a lot of these people in prison have, and not all of them, I'm going to say there's a lot of bad people in prison, you know, like terroristic type or serial killers, but And even the serial killers, I hate to say it, but serious mental illnesses. But a lot of these people in prison were, they as children, they were traumatized. And they grew up with that PTSD, and it was never really diagnosed. And so what happens is we have people that are suffering from all kinds of mental illnesses. Some may come from a good home, and I'm sure your home is an average or a good home, whereas some are coming from dysfunctional houses or homes. They're growing up in houses that are homes that are domestic. There's a lot of domestic violence in it, homes that have a lot of drug or substances going on, a lot of abuse is going on. So these people are not only having mental health issues, but they're also dealing with a lot of other traumas in their lives. So I say a lot of the mental illnesses that are occurring in the United States too have been they've increased because of the environments around them. They've gotten worse, and just like these shootings that are taking place, these people are not only mentally ill, but they're probably growing up in areas they shouldn't be. And I'll tell you another thing is, and I said this, I posted this on social media the other day, there's things going back between the NRA and other people, the politicians and everything. And I say it's simple. In order for anybody to get a gun permit or get a license to carry, give them a psychological evaluation. I think everybody needs a psychological evaluation performed by the right psychologist or psychiatrist or whatever. But there's a lot of different types of illnesses in the environment that they're growing up in, or the environment they're placed in, may make things a lot worse. You know what I'm saying? It's hard for me to explain, and maybe with you and Mariam Jacobs and a few others in the mental health areas to come together and talk about some of these things, because it makes a big difference, especially right now. The United States itself is falling. It's dysfunctional. And there's so many substances in this country now, so much drugs, and it's escalating, and people are being traumatized. And if they don't go to prison, they're committing suicide. It's either homicide or suicide. Or a lot of them are destructive. Now, I'm going to say there was a young man, and I might have brought this up before, on the Cape, who was mentally ill. And every time anybody called the police or called DMH, they were told that the person couldn't do anything unless they committed a crime, unless they harmed somebody. But yet, when people go to prison, Department of Mental Health does not want to get involved. I don't know why, because it's simply opposite of what they advertise.
Yeah.
They say the young man is doing good now. I heard he's home, but I think he might have spent some time in a facility. They probably put him in a mental hospital or something. But growing up in our area of Osterville on Cape Cod, it was frightening to have somebody walking around like that and not knowing, you know, what was going to happen and not getting help from the Department of Mental Health at the time. People were frightened. But they say he's doing good there now.
Good, good. That's good to hear. And I do see a few, you know, some success cases where, you know, people get a second chance. And, you know, that's what I just hope to see. The worth of people being pushed forward, and we have more success stories instead of all these tragedies and all these, you know, heartbreaking stories that you're talking about.
Yeah. And I think sometimes this one in Hyannis, they said he wasn't on his medication. So sometimes they don't take their medications. They can have their episodes or whatever. And that's another thing too, you know, that we have to remember too, is when people are mentally ill, to ensure that they take their medication.
Correct. So yeah. Back to films, you know, the movie Black Swan, I happened to watch that quite a while ago. It was with Natalie Portman. Committed dancer struggles to maintain her sanity after winning the lead role in a production of Swan Lake. And it was a pretty dark film. And you contrast that to the TV show called This Is Us, which I've never watched, but I'm told that, again, like, you know, the Hispanic man, you talked about bringing up, and it can happen to any color, but they happen to, you know, depict a man of color named Randall who had panic attacks. And yet, you know, I'm told that, you know, through the text that they handled this situation very well. So you have something like Black Swan, which just shows this descent into mental illness versus someone who can, you know, who has a mental illness but can handle it well with the right support. So those are, you know, the dichotomy of film and TV shows, that, you know, you can depict it in a very negative light, you can depict it in a very positive light. But they do say that, you know, that there is more awareness and more positivity than there was in the past. So that's, you know, that's a good, very good thing. And you can look up, you know, I simply looked up to get a little bit more versed on this subject that I'm not an expert on. I looked up, you know, 30 great movies about mental illness, or the 15 movies that therapists recommend. So, you know, if you're interested in seeing some of these films, you know, there are a great deal of, you know, they can be entertaining, but they can also be educational, and they can also help to destigmatize. And that's, you know, that's the goal. That's the goal, is to educate people, to destigmatize, and to, you know, make it a better world. The system is broken. The system itself tells us the system is broken. So let's get, you know, let's get together and fix it. I like action. I get frustrated with just talk. You know, you people get willing to listen and no action.
If you like action, I'm going to say one thing. You, family, friends, and individuals for the mentally ill and Bridgewater Families Group should reach out to these celebrities who all have mental illnesses. If you type in on the computer celebrities with mental illnesses, you're going to find that Debbie Lovato has mental illnesses, Selena Gomez, Lady Gaga, Crystal Bell, Carrie Fisher, Dwayne Johnson, Britney Spears. These are all people who have mental illnesses. Karen Delvini, it's a French name, I can't pronounce. Lena Dunham, Mariah Carey, Ariana Grande, Ryan Reynolds, Emma Stone, Zayn, Kid Cudi, Chrissy Teigen, Jim Carrey, Peter Wentz, Michael Phelps, Wayne Brady, Katy Perry, Kendall Jenner, and Halle Berry, and Sinead O'Connor. These are all celebrities with mental health problems, all of them.
Well,
you can find them just by typing in celebrities with mental illnesses.
Well, that's quite a big list. And I just read of one woman, and I can't recall her name, but she was seen wandering naked and had to be, you know, she went to a psychiatric facility and then was released, and people are still very concerned for her. So it's heartbreaking. Again, you know, where is the it takes a village mindset? Do we have any of that? I guess I think I cited wrongly when I said the United States, I think we incarcerate 5 times more than the UK and 12 times more in Japan. And Japan, I think, you know, they're very culturally strong and very culturally together, the way they run their school system with school uniforms, with respect, great respect for the teachers, and they have 12 times less incarceration in their society, you know, because there really is a lot of respect for elders, for, you know, the, like the bureaucracy, whoever is it. It was really funny. One situation, my husband worked for a Japanese company, and they were going to be repainting offices. So the guy on top, the big man who they all liked and respected, he got everybody together, and he took them around, and they discussed paint colors, and it ended up he was the one who picked the color he liked. You know, yeah. But there's a respect in that. But it was just kind of funny that he brought them all in, but he was the one to decide. But, you know, they're culturally, they're very together, much more so than, you know, there's something to be said that's good about diversity, but we also have to have community within that diversity.
Exactly.
And, another thing, you know, the Japanese people, we got to befriend a lot of them because they were co-workers with my husband, and they would come from Japan to work in the United States with him. And they liked the diversity, you know, they enjoyed the diversity of the United States. But there's also something about that cultural cohesiveness that the Japanese enjoy. And even if we're diverse, we're still all human beings, you know, and if we just, there were more of a sense of it takes a village, maybe some of our problems in our country could be solved.
Exactly. Exactly. It takes
my husband, you know, will one day tell me, you know, most of the time he thinks I'm optimistic, and then other times he thinks, you know, because of the way we see the world and the way the world is, that I can also be cynical. So it's a hard world to navigate.
You know, the thing is, Donna, it gets frustrating because you see the problem, I see the problem, and so many people see the problems, but the ones that can make a difference, the ones that are influential, the ones that lead the country, that talk about caring for the American people, those are the ones that need to change. Because we have to look, and I'll tell you, I'm going to bring this up because we're talking about the death penalty, and I said this the other day. You don't kill somebody that has killed somebody just because we're a government, just because we're leaders of the country, or because of uniforms or titles. It's two wrongs don't make a right. So what we need to do is we need to look at the individual cases, and we also have to look at the mental health issues. We have a state in the United States of a governor that is paralyzed. He can't get out of his wheelchair. And that is the state that has the most people on death row or executions. And it's in the Constitution that mentally ill people should not be or cannot be executed. And yet there's been so many wrongfully convicted and so many mentally ill people that have been actually executed. We have to have some kind of feelings in this country because, as you say, the UK, all the other countries, and Washington, I just found out, as a matter of fact, I posted it on LinkedIn because Marion Jacobs posted it to me, but Washington State has now started to use the European model in their state for incarceration. And I'm hoping that other states will also do the same thing because they treat people like human beings, regardless of the situation. And this is what we don't have in the United States of America. We have people that are being looked down upon, that are being hated, that are being with not only races, but with social statuses, money-wise, you know, the ones that have billions of dollars compared to the ones that are out in the streets or whatever. But we have to start looking at people as human beings and as our fellow citizens. The United States consists of representatives from all over the world, and that's what's so sad, because that's what countries look at with the United States. They respected the United States because it was unified with representatives from all over the country. And now there's so much hatred, so much division, there's so much mental illnesses, so many drugs, there's so much, everything is going on in this country. It's like a roller coaster, ups and downs every day.
True. And you know, the wrongs to be righted are deep-seated, they're complex, they're decades in the making.
Yeah.
You know, but we can't get discouraged. You know, we have to, you know, we have to keep talking humane treatment. We have to keep talking. Let's do the right thing. We have to push compassion. We have to push empathy. You know, we have to just never give up.
I think that's why you and your husband are such a perfect couple. You not only make a beautiful couple, I've seen your picture together on social media, but you also have that calming effect, the way you talk, the positivity in your voices and all that. So, but there's not enough Mr. and Mrs. Wynette in the country and in the world, and that's what we need more of in this country. And unfortunately, this is what's lacking. People are lacking that true compassion. They prejudge. The media only reports one-sided stories. The media is the big problem, because if they were to report everything, you know, they might report something happening, a crime happening, but they don't report the part about the person being, you know, psychologically ill.
Correct. Yeah, I had a friend call today, and, you know, she's hammering, and I've stopped watching a lot of the news because I was getting caught up, and I don't want the divisions. I don't want the divisions in my heart. And
no.
So, you know, I listen to the news enough to keep apprised of what's going on, but, you know, I'm no longer a news junkie. And she just started in on one side of the aisle. And, you know, as if this one side is vilified. And, you know, there's a lack of veracity. There's this, there's that. But it's on both sides. As you said, there's division. And you know, it's if this is what's running the country, we're in big trouble.
Yeah.
We're going to be, you know, the divided states of America, unfortunately. So that being said, you know, before we end the show, I'd like to talk about what a continuum of care and a model treatment plan would look like, if that's okay. So, defining what a continuum of care or a model treatment plan might look like. So, my organization, FEMI, plus the Bridgewater Families Group, is working to gather as much information as possible as to what constitutes a model treatment plan that is comprehensive and humane. By understanding what a good treatment plan looks like, we will be able to better advocate for those points. So Senator Cindy Friedman, she's a former chairperson now. She's now Ways and Means Committee and many other good things, but when she was the chairperson of the Joint Committee of Mental Illness and Substance Abuse, she tells us that the humane care for those with serious mental illness need and deserve includes the provision of proper medical, clinical, and psychiatric care, which is our mantra as well. So one of our consultants to FEMI, who was a former steering committee member, provided us from 3 points. Now, this comes from his vantage point of having served as a psychiatric pharmacist at Worcester Recovery Center. So that he was a unique person on our steering committee. Our steering committee, you know, there are people so committed and they have such gifts and talents and experience and credentials and heart, which is the utmost thing. So this former psychiatric pharmacist from Worcester Recovery Center said, number one, you need to provide a safe environment for staff and patients. Sorry about that. I'll read that again. Provide a safe environment for staff and patients. And I would add to that, you know, by kind treatment, you know, it might not eliminate all violent behavior, which sometimes happens to people with mental illness, but it would mitigate it a great deal. The better the treatment, the kinder the treatment, I believe, you know, the less trauma and violence these people might act out on, and that would make it safer. He also goes on to say to provide good psychotherapy and gain a good understanding of the proper, and then he says, you know, as a pharmacist, he says medication is one key element if you use it in the right way. And then I would add some other elements that FEMI has come up with. You know, we're always defining what a good treatment model would be, so we have something to offer those we tell this is what we want. So number four would be to treat the trauma, and we would want evidence-based treatment, that is using treatments that have been tried and tested and have proved to be successful, and encourage and allow patients some control so as to allow them to also help themselves to the best of their potential. And then I would say, you know, maybe provide some of these people with serious mental illness, provide them recovery coaches, maybe peer specialists, you know, mentors with experience and sponsors so that they can live in the community or in a facility to the best of their potential. And then one of the things I'd like to see is an expansion of mental health courts, which I can go into some other show. Miami-Dade County in Florida is doing great things in those areas. But this, you know, right now mental health courts are great, but it usually only accommodates those who have a mental illness of lesser charges. So some of the things that we'd like to see would be an expansion of the mental health courts that would deal with all the charges, not just the misdemeanors, with judges who have the training in dealing with and an understanding of the complexities of behavior of the mentally ill. That would, to me, that would help eliminate incarcerations of people with serious mental illness, get them the assistance they need and the facilities that they need, the proper facilities. So that's some of the goals.
I totally agree with that. And, you know, I also think, and I mention this all the time too, the parole board, you know, there were times when I used to get so many letters requesting that I be on jury duty, just like all of you, I'm sure. But being on jury duty all the time, if we can be on jury duty, they should allow, instead of having the parole board consisting of people in the government or in the penal system, they need to look at bringing in people in the communities, psychologists, social workers, you know, people that they normally would have on jury duty should be also be allowed to be at parole board hearings. You know, I just feel that way. And I'm going to, I wanted to bring up too on LinkedIn. Her name is Vanessa Roje. She's a formerly incarcerated student at the Myra Costa College. And her she has here, "Don't judge me based on my past. Judge my effort and my determination to have a positive impact on the world. I believe in second chances, and I believe we all have potential. We all have the capacity to do great things to help make the world a better place. If you are with me, then walk beside me. If not, I respectfully ask you to move out of the way, because there is no stopping a woman with a made-up mind. My mind is set to rise above my past and any negative judgment about people from my population. I just had to say that, and I know there is always going to be opposition, but that won't stop me." And it was an event she was having. She had it on April 12th, Wednesday, Second Chance Month. She had a mass incarceration talk. I guess it was a virtual meeting.
That's excellent. Excellent. You know, it's people with that firsthand experience that can teach us so much. And I just want to, you know, before we end the show, just say how important family involvement in treatment is. So, you know, it's very, sometimes the family members don't know how to navigate and can live with difficult situations when their loved ones have a mental illness, but you know, they're very, the caring family members mean everything, and they need to have, you know, families need to have involvement in the treatment of their loved ones. And right now, we're actually fighting, the families of Bridgewater State Hospital are fighting negotiating fiercely with the administration, because they've drastically cut down our hours and they've made it really difficult. They've had late evening hours. Many people travel as much as 2.5 hours each way, and that's not uncommon, Leona. And many people who come for visitation are older. They have night vision, health issues, safety issues, worries about late hours, and they're just making it, and they curtailed and cut our visitations, you know, without any input from the families. And we're just fighting for our family involvement, because that is of the utmost importance. So that's where, you know, we're at as far as the Bridgewater Families Group right now. There's many issues, but that's, you know, that's a hot topic right now.
You know, that's sad because what you're doing, and I think that's why they're doing it, because there's a lot of positive things starting to happen around the country with prison reform, but it's also going to be affecting those large corporations that are making money off of the mass incarceration. So they are going to, as you progress, they're going to make it more difficult. They're going to. You know, what they're doing with mail in not only Pennsylvania, but in Florida, other places too, the mail is all going down to Florida or Texas, and it's being, when you write to anybody in Pennsylvania or those states, it goes to another state first, and then it goes back to their state, and they get copies of the mail. They don't get the original. Massachusetts does not give them the original either. They give them the copies. So right now, they're making it very difficult. If you ever experience this, if you're on the phone, sometimes you will be talking, and all of a sudden you won't hear anything at either end. So you're paying for the call, but you're not getting the full 15 or 20 minutes of it. These are a lot of the things that they're starting to do now and making it more difficult for families to stay together, you know, in connection or have longer periods of time. I myself have not seen my loved one in almost 10 years, and we communicate by phone or mail at times. But these are the things that they will do, and this is discouraging prisoners and people incarcerated not to have visits or not to have this communication, because it only stresses them out more, especially if they're having psychological issues.
Correct. They've already been traumatized, and, you know, to take away any kind of familial or family comfort and support, you know, and cause family separation, it's just... To me, it's immoral and wrong.
It's sad. It really
and
is.
Destructive. It's destructive. It's just destructive to a civil society, a kind society, a better society.
Well, they say when you're doing something right, you're going to have all kinds of opposition, and it's coming from the very places that are trying to bring about such disaster. Donna, I had promised you that you were going to host this entire show, but no one came, none of your group came on today, so I was pretty much responding in place of them.
I'm really glad.
I was surprised, but then again, I know that everybody's working and times are, I've been putting on shows at nighttime at 6:30 at night too. So if it ever gets to the point where you want to have an evening show so you can bring on anyone in your groups that are working, feel free to do so.
Thank you.
I want to let you do your own show, to host your own show, because you have so much knowledge and you've been so active, and your group has as well. So the next time, hopefully they'll come on, and I will, as the Apostle Paul told the followers, when the Christ came into the picture, I back away, he takes over. And that's what I want you to do. I want you to be able to run your own show and talk about the issues that all of you are working with. So we have we have a few more minutes if you want to finish up.
Okay. Let me think. Let's see if I can find a good ending here.
Also, if you want to give the audience your contact information in case they want to join or volunteer or do anything.
Oh, that would be great. And good news is that we do have some new volunteers, you know, offering to help us. So, you know, that's quite needed. But to learn more about FEMI, my organization, our organization, you just go to FFIMI.blog. So that's FFIMI.blog. And to contact us, to ask for a newsletter, a free quarterly newsletter, or to, you know, offer any kind of opinion or ask for support, you would go to FFIMI.inquiry@gmail.com. So that's FFIMI.inquiry@gmail.com. And you can learn, you know, you can just ask, say, I would like to learn more about your organization. We'll send you our mission statement, who we are, et cetera. So, you know, all opinions, all questions are welcome.
Thank you so much, Donna, and I really appreciate you coming on because you are not only educating the audience, but you're also educating me on a lot of this, these things, and I thank you so much. You are a true warrior, a fighter for justice in the mental health arena, and I thank you so much, and I hope that Department of Mental Health will break down and start working with all of you and with the incarcerated people who have mental illnesses in the United States. So thank you so much.
That would be wonderful. Thank you, Leona. And good things are starting to happen. We're getting some helpers. So, you know, I want to assure my fellow Bridgewater Families Group and FEMI that, you know, there's movement and there's good things coming. So, you know, as you said, there are people trying to shut us down, Leona. It's so true. And yet, you know, there's people stepping up to help. So, you know, just we'll keep on fighting the good fight, Leona. Thank you for all you do as well. It's just so helpful to get the word out.
You're a blessing, Donna, and I thank you once again for coming on. Donna Winnett, Families, Friends, and Individuals for the Mentally Ill, will be back on again, and she will be running the show the next time. Hopefully we won't have me keep interrupting, Donna, but thank you so much.
I enjoyed it, Leona, truly. And it would have been hard to talk all by myself an hour and a half.
Let me know, though, when you and the crew are able to come on again, and I will set it up and welcome you very much. Thank you so much, Donna.
Thank you. Have a good day, Leona. God bless you. Bye-bye.
Thank you, audience. Thank you for listening in, and we are now going to end this episode. And as of Monday at 6:30 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time, we will have with us, I have a guest coming on, and it is CJ Bua, Advocate for the Voiceless and Fighter for the Unheard. She will be on Monday, and that will be on the 24th, 2023, at 6:30 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time. Thank you so much, audience, and we are now going to close this episode.